the Chief Judge and the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. Court calls the case of United States versus Captain Harold B. Johnson, miscellaneous docket number 2017-01. We ordered oral argument on the following issues. Whether this court has jurisdiction under Article 62A1A, Uniform Code of Military Justice, to hear the government's appeal of the military judge's abatement order in this case. If this court should find jurisdiction lacking under Article 62A1A, might the court properly consider the government's appeal as a petition for extraordinary relief under the All Writs Act? Whether the military judge erred by abating the proceedings, and whether the administrative processing of a request to retire in lieu of court-martial is within the scope of the military judge's authority. Given the number of issues and the fact that the parties did not have the opportunity to brief all of them, we permit the parties 10 additional minutes for a total of 40 minutes each for oral argument. Government counsel, do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 8 minutes.
Very well, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Drew, Senior Judge Brown, Judge Meek, may it please the court. I am Captain Tyler Musselman, and with me is Colonel Catherine Oler, and together we represent the United States in this proceeding. The military judge exceeded his authority when he evaded the proceedings in this case. He inappropriately conflated the court-martial process with an administrative personnel procedure handled outside of the court-martial. What's more, in lieu of deferring to the agencies responsible for administrating that regulation, the military judge based his decision on his own interpretation of the reg. Regardless of whether it's under an Article 62 or extraordinary writ process, the military judge's usurpation of judicial authority necessitates reversal of his abatement ruling. In addressing the issues today, I'd like to first discuss why this court has jurisdiction under Article 62 UCMJ, then turn to why it's appropriate for this court to consider these issues as a case for petition for extraordinary relief for the writ of mandamus in the event that it finds it lacks jurisdiction under Article 62. Then turn to why a grant of relief under Article 62 or an extraordinary writ is necessary in this case. Now first, whether this court has jurisdiction under Article 62 UCMJ, this case is ripe for review under Article 62 as intractability set in when the military judge issued his final abatement ruling. Now obviously I think the hitch of this question is whether or not in this case, given that the government has stated that it will process a retilo when the appellee gains retirement eligibility, whether that forecloses the application of right and true in this case.
Right. So, counsel, it does bring us to, if you will, a definitional question about what intractability means. Surely it doesn't simply mean that the parties have both kind of decided what their positions are and have staked those positions out, because that seems to occur in every single court-martial on virtually every single issue before the court. So intractability must mean something more than that. What's the government's view as to what intractability means and whether or not we have it in this case?
I think that it means within the context of these issues, a refusal to comply with the military judge's rule. And you see that in right and in true. In true, it was the military judge's ruling for an expert witness for the defense. The Commanding Authority stated he wasn't going to pay for that. In right, I believe it was turning over documents the government contended were privileged. Intractability, I think another definition is insolvability. I think that's what it means. I do think that, and as my colleague briefed, there's an issue of, well, can a continuance be appealed under Article 62 UCMJ? In other words, if the judge says, we're going to continue the case until Thursday for this witness to arrive, and I don't think a continuance can be appealed under Article 62, but I don't think that's what we have here. I think that there's a fact in this case that separates this from a continuance, and that's the fact that the retilo has been returned. It's been rejected. In other words, the retilo that was submitted is not currently pending before anyone. It's been returned. There has been no further submission of another retilo. And I think that's why the military judge, in his ruling, found in one way or another, right now the case is done from my standpoint, at least at this point.
All right, counsel, in your brief, in your reply brief, you state that, quote, the condition prohibiting processing of appellee's retilo will persist until 15 August 2017, not 10 May 2017, as claimed by appellee, end quote. So on 15 August 2017, so in about 2 to 3 months, is there anything to prohibit processing of appellee's retilo?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the retilo that he submitted has been rejected and returned. If he submits another one or resubmits it, then the government will process it on August 15th as he will have retained retirement eligibility.
Okay, so as you view this, and this was not clear from the record, so my follow-up question would be, where can we look to get answers to this question, is this is not just a package that's sitting at some office somewhere waiting for 15 May, and when 15 May hits, you're going to then forward it back up and say, now he's eligible to retire as an officer. That's not the situation we have before us?
Well, Your Honor, switching August, and I would say that Appellate Exhibit Roman numeral 13 is the SAF MRBP memorandum that the judge incorporated into his oral ruling on the final abatement procedure, stating that it's been rejected and...
It says return with no action.
Right, so it's been returned. In other words,
but return where? Wasn't the testimony of Colonel Hugan that the process is if an application, you were to make it all the way up to the outer office, if you will, of the Personnel Council, and it was determined by that outer office that it was that the individual was not eligible for whatever relief they were seeking. Retirements are one thing that they deal with. They deal with a whole lot of other personnel issues, but to focus on retirements. It's my recollection that her testimony was if that office gets such an application and they determine that the individual is not eligible for whatever they're seeking, in this case retirement, that they would, quote, return it to the originating office. And so that's what the record shows. I don't know that we have anything in the record to indicate whether that originating office, whether that was the personnel office at the installation, Peterson, I believe, or some other office in the meanwhile. But what we don't have in the record is any indication that that originating office tore it up, returned it to the member, did anything else. And it also begs the question about how this situation would be any different than the situation that the judge started with. That is, when the special court martial convening authority looking at the application and determining that the appellee was not eligible to retire, returned it to him without action. But nevertheless, after the judge issued his initial set of rulings, that application, apparently the same application, maybe you can clarify, was nevertheless processed beyond the special court martial convening authority to eventually to get up to at least close to the personnel council. So can you explain, first of all, because it is important whether there is an application in some office with the Air Force that if the Air Force chose to do so for whatever reason, it could process, whether it be further process, reprocess, or something, some other kind of processing, or is there nothing at all, and the only way that the Air Force could process anything is if the appellee filed a new application for retirement in lieu?
Well, yeah, what I would say is that we have a memorandum saying it's been returned, and what we don't have are any facts in the record that say it's currently being reviewed and processed. And I would say that...
Okay, so we have a memorandum saying it's returned without action. Not rejected, but returned without action. Again, rejection, using, I guess, in a generic sense, it was they're not processing it further. But it certainly wasn't a substantive determination of a yes or a no. It was returned without action. But how is that different than what we had from the special court martial convening authority back in August, I believe it was, where he returned the same application, or a version of it at least, without action.
Well, I think then you had the litigation at the court-martial in which the appellee advanced his position that it should be routed back through, and the government routed it.
Right, so. But the question is, if it was returned, then would he not have had to resubmit, and do we have anything in the record to indicate that he did resubmit, or did the government take what they already had? You know, return is more of virtual process. They don't take the application, put it to the shredder or burn it or anything. It appears that they took the very same application and then said, understand that the trial judge said we had to process it, and then they processed it. And so the question is, if that's correct, and that's my reading of the record, but if you see something different, I'd be very, very interested in that. But if that's correct, how is this really any different? Both of them returned it. It's obviously returned at a different level. But certainly in the former case, it appears, and the question is, in this case now, is there, in fact, a package that if the Air Force chose to do so, which is a big if, obviously, but if the Air Force chose to do so, they could process without any further action on the part of the appellee?
I think that we're speculating on facts that don't exist in the record. In other words, what did they do with the first one, and is there one currently processing or pending? There's nothing on the record that says that the special court-martial or the general court-martial convening authority is currently reviewing the package.
Okay, we'll stop you, though, and I understand I'm not letting you fully answer, but it's a compound question, so I'll try to break it down. In the record, we clearly show an original application and then there's some indication that there had to be some supplemental information that went into it because there was a form or whatever, and that's what allowed the permission to proceed to be filed because it was an incomplete application. But there was an original application filed in August, I believe, that applied for retirement as an enlisted or officer, and then we have this other document in September that was a supplement or something to that effect to say that the appellee only wanted to retire as an officer at that point, not enlisted. We'll come back, by the way, because I'm very interested as to the legal significance of that second document. But then we have the Special Court Martial Convening Authority returning those documents back without action. We have the initial ruling of the military judge, which he adhered to a week or so later on reconsideration. And what the record does not reflect is after that military judge's ruling that the appellee submitted anything anew. It appears that they took these other two documents, which had been, quote, returned by the Special Court Martial Convening Authority, and then processed them. And so the question is, first of all, if that's correct, I see nothing in the record to indicate otherwise, but if you're aware of something, I would like to know that. But if that is correct, how is that any different than the package later being returned without action, but yet physically still residing within the computers, if nothing else, of the Air Force? Why couldn't the Air Force at this very moment continue to process that returned application if they wish to, by returning it back up to the Air Force Personnel Council?
Because you have a request, and that's the appellee's motion through the court-martial, through the military judge, that he's requesting the Air Force process the package that he had previously submitted.
Isn't that what he's been requesting all along and to this very day?
Well, we don't have that here. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that it's been returned, and there needs to be a subsequent request by the appellee to process. I think that if this court finds that the military judge is outside of his lane, and then August 15th comes up again, the Air Force is going to look for appellee to submit that. I think at that point.
So you don't interpret the appellee's positions on the 1st of March, after the Personnel Council took action returning without action? The word action, I think, also may have some legal significance that is a bit confusing here. But you don't interpret the position of the defense before the military judge as asking the government to process his application for retirement? Isn't that what he's asking today?
Well, Your Honor, I think what we have is there any fact in the record that shows that the appellee's case is being processed through channels, or how it was done the
right
first time?
That's not my question. Well, I agree with you. I think that there doesn't seem to be anything that it's processing. The question is, much like when after the Special Court Martial Convening Authority, I'm going to use the term generically, rejected it, There was no more processing until the judge said, basically, process. And then they started processing. But there doesn't appear to be anything in the record that after the judge said, process, that the appellee submitted anything more. It appears that they processed the previously rejected package. And so my question is, it doesn't appear that there's any processing going on right now. That much does appear clear. But why couldn't, if the government wanted to, and I'm not saying the government wants to, I'm just asking what's the authority that the government has. If the government wanted to, would they be able, without the appellee doing anything more, other than on 1 March expressing his desire, and in his pleadings before this court, expressing his desire that the Air Force retire him, which seems to suggest he's still asking for that. Why couldn't the Air Force take the package that was returned to the originating office without action? Why couldn't they process that if they wanted to include potentially taking action on an application that he may be eligible for at this point?
Because it's my position is because it's been returned by the board, and so they require new. I think, Your Honor, when you're saying there, it appears that he never made a subsequent request, you're presuming facts, and we're in an Article 62. So I don't think the court can presume a fact the first time around. In other words, that he didn't make another formal request.
Do we have anything in the record indicating that there was a subsequent request? And in fact, all we seem to have are factual findings by the military judge focusing strictly on an original application in August and a request to supplement in September, and no other request. Is that correct?
That's right. Just like there's no facts that there wasn't a request. I think if the court finds a lack of jurisdiction under Article 62 because there's and presumes that it was processed without a subsequent request from the appellee, then there's a presumption of facts there that are going to lead to a decision. I think that this court has to look into what's not in the record and what is. And I think what is in the record is here we have a memorandum returning the application. And so I think if this court were to up or to reverse the military judge's decision and August 15th came around, the Air Force is not going to sua sponte route his package. I think he's going to have to request it.
All
in
right.
other words, the court martial will be on the track to proceed at that point, and there needs to
right.
be
so your
decision.
Your position is that in the absence of the appellee doing anything more other than the positions he's taken at the trial and the positions he's taken thus far in this court, is the only way for the Air Force to process a retirement in lieu of court-martial is for the appellee to do something more, file a new application or do something more along the lines of, you know, asking for his original application to be reconsidered?
Yes, because it's been returned.
Okay. And you're saying that the return by the outer office of the Personnel Council somehow has a legal significance different than the return by the special court-martial convening authority?
I don't know if they do or not. There's not facts.
The record is silent on it. Okay. Then my follow-up question is, and again, the record is silent, so you may not be able to answer it, but I am intrigued if you saw something in the record I did not. And that is, the application that was returned by the Personnel Council, the application that made it all the way up to the Personnel Council, was that an application to retire only as an officer, or was it an application to retire as an enlisted man or an officer, but request to retire as an officer?
My understanding is it's the application that's in the record and attached to the defense's first motion, which revoked the conditional aspect of his retirement request and is solely to retire as an officer.
And is it your position that the appellee has the authority and legal ability to revoke his request to retire once he has submitted it? And I note that attached to that request was an acknowledgement that he may not withdraw that request without the secretarial approval to withdraw the request.
Yeah, yeah, that's our position, I think, because of the conditional nature that he revoked that.
So would that mean that the only way he could withdraw his request to retire as an enlisted member or officer and change it to request to retire only as an officer, that would require the Secretary of the Air Force to concur?
Well, I think either way it's moved because it's been returned. I think that when you look at what his intention is, it's to retire as an officer, which he won't gain eligibility until August 15th. I think that I haven't seen where he didn't revoke his request to retire, he changed the conditional nature of it. And frankly, I haven't looked in the regs at that specific issue, but I don't know that he's prohibited from doing so.
Well, he changed one conditional nature of it. He didn't change the other conditional nature of it, which was not to retire until he was eligible to retire as an officer, meaning there was a time condition in his retirement request. Is that correct?
Right. Yes, Your Honor. And I think even if this court finds it doesn't have jurisdiction under Article 62, it should look at this case, and the United States asks it to look at this case, as a petition for extraordinary writ in the nature of a writ of mandamus. And get that proposition from Mahoney, in that case where Article 62 jurisdiction failed in the court.
Can you give us which Mahoney? There's several.
Sorry, Your Honor. It was the one cited in our briefs. It's going to be 24 MJ 911. That's the Air Force Court of Military Review, 1987.
Okay. And I don't say that facetiously. There literally are at least three Mahoney decisions that are relevant to the issues before.
Yes, Your Honor. And in that case, where Article 62 jurisdiction failed, it was looked at a petition for extraordinary writ. CAF has held in Curtin that the government may file a petition for extraordinary writ with the appropriate Court of Military Review, now the Court of Criminal Appeals. That decision has never been overturned. In other words, the government has the ability to file extradits in request at this stage that this court do so. Obviously, we didn't file it in paper. I would acknowledge that whether an extraordinary writ becomes ripe depends on this court's decision on Article 62. In other words, we wouldn't be able to file an extraordinary writ unless this court rejects jurisdiction under Article 62. And, of course, the proceedings are abated. I do think it's appropriate for this court to look at it in that framework, especially concerning the issues we have. Now, if this was just about the regulation and interpreting the regulation, I would not stand up here and tell you that the government has met its burden for an extraordinary writ. This is about the military judge exceeding his scope, respectfully stepping out of his lane. And I say that because of the administrative personnel nature of this decision. And what precipitated the abatement ruling, which was the interpretation and decision-making in regards to a personnel rating. That comes mainly from this court's decision in Shute, and then also looking at what the Navy Court held in Bledsoe, and ultimately the idea that was sort of advanced by the Supreme Court in Goldsmith. Now, in Shute, you have the discharge in lieu, and the appellant argued to this court's predecessor that it was that it was done erroneously. It was rejected by the Special Court Martial Convening Authority, I think, when it should have been formatted up. And this court looked and said, not every administrative right impacts the court martial. I think it's important to note that neither the military judge nor the defense cited any authority for why the military judge had the ability to rule on this issue.
Well, I did see that you cited Shoup, and that was helpful. And you cited it for the proposition you just stated, but I must admit I was a little troubled because immediately after the part of Shoup that supports the statement that you've cited for, it has the following quote: however, if a properly processed discharge or resignation action would have abated court-martial proceedings, a failure to process such action through to completion may be grounds for due process review, and it cites the Coma case of United States versus Woods in 1988. I mean, at least at first blush, if that's correct, bearing in mind this is Shoup is an Air Force case, they're citing to a CAP, to a Court of Military Appeals case, if that, assuming that they're citing it correctly, that seems to actually run completely counter to the argument for which you were citing us to Shoup, does it not?
I disagree, Your Honor. And if you look at Woods, that's actually an interesting case, because in that case, the appellant was court-martialed, convicted, and then the secretary actually approved the resignation. And so when CAF was referring to abatement, it was actually abatement at CAF's level. In other words, the issue that CAF was actually looking at wasn't abatement at the court-martial level, it was abatement at CAF's level, and actually set aside and dismissed the charges. I also would point out that in Shoup, this court found that abatement and due process rights that it said were identified through the abatement weren't triggered in that case because A, it was rejected prior to court-martial charges. The resignation was rejected prior to court-martial charges starting, and the reg didn't require abatement.
Right, which is not our facts. I mean, here, the request to retire was filed after charges had been preferred, and I believe referred. So
right.
that part of the reg, it seems that the appellee has clearly complied with. Now, obviously, the broader question is whether, nevertheless, he was entitled to submit a request
given the fact that he was not at that moment eligible to retire, which is the substantive thing, which I know you're dying to talk about. But in the case of Woods, that was an indication or a case in which the Secretary of the Army, I believe it was, after the court-martial was over, essentially set aside the dismissal and replaced it with a retirement in lieu that had not yet been processed at the time of the court-martial. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that here I can't identify any regulation procedure requiring abatement. The AFI requires abatement in the aspects of RILOs. I know that was interpreted by the parties to cover abatement for RILOs, and that there was a permission to proceed in this case. So I would say that factually this is similar to Shook, especially given that the permission to proceed was granted, and then you have the rejection. The question is not, does he have a due process right in the how the reg is actually, or how the retitle is processed, but is there a due process right to abate the proceedings until a decision's been made? And so by the time the judge made his final abatement decision, you've already been granted a permission to proceed, and it's already been returned. And so it is factually on point with Shook. I think the due process thing that was identified by this court in Shook was, is there a due process right in having the thing put on hold until a decision is made? But here we have the permission to proceed, and it's been returned. And so, therefore, the abatement issue is not in play. And so we are in a strictly administrative realm.
Well, on the request to, or the granting of the permission to proceed, what, if any, relevance does that have today? In other words, it appears the judge was fully prepared to proceed to trial in November. And at that point, the application was now being processed but had not been completed, had not made it up to the secretarial level or the personnel council's level. 1 November, you get the permission to proceed issued by JAJM. 30 November, they're going to trial, but it gets continued for completely unrelated issues, discovery related. But doesn't it appear that at least at that time, the military judge was willing to proceed with trial even though the action had not been finalized yet?
I agree. And I think what you need to look at, Your Honor, is the fact that the permission to proceed was in play when he issued his abatement ruling. So if you apply...
which of the three?
The last one, Your Honor. The last abatement ruling. So what you have is you have a permission to proceed in play, and then you have the fact that it's been returned. And so none of, as far as like a due process right in abating that was identified in Shook is in play when the military judge made his final abatement ruling.
Well, let me ask you this. The permission to proceed... Do you think that has any relevance on 1 March, after the outer office of the Personnel Council has returned without action the application? Do you think the permission to proceed still is in play and basically the trial should have proceeded? Or do you think that now permission to proceed is now moot, if you will, because it's been processed as far as the Air Force is going to process?
Well, I would say it's moot because if there was a requirement to abate, which there wasn't, then it would have been gone anyway when the application was returned.
Yeah, and I think I would ask not to use the term abate for the administrative processing. It gets a bit confusing. Abatement, you know, clearly the trial judge abated. And I recognize that some of the cases use the term abate more generally, but suspend would probably be maybe a different, if not more accurate, term when we're talking about the administrative suspension. But it appears that the judge conceded or at least acquiesced in the authority of the administrative parallel authorities, if you will, in this case JAJM, to have at least some influence on whether the trial proceeded. In other words, permission to proceed was issued, notwithstanding his previous order abating. On 30 November, he allowed the trial to proceed until it got continued. So it appears that he acknowledged the authority of JAJM, and which brings into this question of the parallel authorities and to what degree is the, whether you call it deference in interpretation or whether you call it something else, to what degree was the military judge bound by the call of JAJM and granting permission to proceed pending whatever was going to happen with his RILO? In other words, was he now contrary to that permission to proceed when he abated the proceedings on 1 March? Or is it just completely irrelevant because it had been returned?
I don't think I fully understand your question, but what I'll do, I'll compare it to the procedures that are in place for a RILO, resignation in lieu, which are in the AFI.
Yes.
If you look, that directs the government actors, in other words, trial counsel, the legal office, to hold stop on any court-martial. In other words, it looks like they're going to be the ones that have to recognize a continuance in a court-martial if a resignation in lieu of has been permitted. I don't think those procedures apply to a retilo, but if they do, that's kind of what you're talking about. That's how it would apply.
Do we know that they don't? Do we know that they don't? Because there is the one sentence in the section of AFI 51201 that just basically says, it's in the section dealing with resignations in lieu or RILOs, that just says, if you get a retirement in lieu, call JAJM. And then something will happen thereafter, apparently. And so it appears that, at least at the trial level, people are assuming that there is some relevance to that RILO section of 51201 when it pertains to retirements in lieu, to include this, the either whether it's a necessity or implication of permission to proceed.
Well, I'll tell you, in practice, I think that JAJM treats them the same, and I think that was in the record. And so that, to be frank with the court, they treat them the same, but as far as whether it's in the reg, I would tell you that if the judge issued an abatement ruling and then recognized the permission to proceed, that seems to me to be an acknowledgement that there was nothing really requiring abatement at that point. That's how I would treat that. I still think that this case is on par with Shook, because by the time the judge made his third and final abatement ruling, any due process right and a hold stop until that retilo was processed was gone because of what the agency had acted on it and returned it. And so I want to make clear, I think Shook talks about the due process right of the abatement, and like I said, Woods is frankly distinguishable from all of this.
All right. Real quickly, not to cut you off, but before you run out of time, despite our giving you extended time, I'm asking you a lot of questions, so this is why we gave you extra time. I would like you to address the word action. You just said that, you know, the government had acted on the application, and therefore there was no longer a due process right to be exercised, if you will. And it seems the judge focused very largely on the word action. In his original orders, he debated until they acted in conformity with the regulations. And then we have this document, we'll call it a document, from the outer office of the Personnel Council returning without action. And so does that word action mean anything of legal significance? May we interpret that document that says it's a return of without action as a generically an action of the secretary or someone authorized in some capacity to act on behalf of the secretary?
Yes, sir. I don't see why not. And frankly, that would be one way to recognize the deference that's owed to those agencies. And by that is they took the action they saw necessary. I think the way the military judge was looking at it in a legal sense was approve or deny the retilo. And I think what you see in the record is there's discussion about how to actually approve or deny it has to go to the council or the board that's responsible for it. Here it was stopped short because it was not eligible for consideration by them.
Right. In your last 30 seconds, knowing that you reserved, I think it was 8 minutes or so, maybe we'll give you a little more freedom, but I make no promises in your 8 minutes. But in your last 30 seconds, can you tell us from your view, aside from the way the military judge interpreted, what options would the secretary have had with his application? Approve? Disapprove? Those seem to be clear. Was that all the secretary's options, or did the secretary have any other options to act, if you will, or just to process this application? And if there were any other options other than just approve and disapprove, what, in your view, would those be?
I'm not quite understanding your question, Your Honor. I guess reject.
What do you mean by reject?
If it's not right for consideration.
Okay, so approve, you can retire. Disapprove, you can't retire. You use the term reject, meaning we're not saying you can't retire, we're not saying you can retire, but we're rejecting the application, we're not acting on the application?
Yes, sir.
Were there any other options in your view?
Not that I can think of, Your Honor.
Could the secretary or someone acting on behalf of the secretary have said rightfully and lawfully and in compliance with the regulations, essentially say, Got it? We're going to hold it right here. We're going to watch and see how this trial proceeds. We're going to see what happens, whether there's a conviction or an acquittal. We're going to see if there's a sentence. And we're going to consider what that sentence is. And then after we have that information, then the secretary will decide which of the other three options to execute. Would that have been a lawful option for the secretary to hold pending outcome of the court martial?
Well, I think that would be in contradiction to the regulations that are in place.
Does the regulation have a time standard? Does it have to, does it say the secretary must take one of the previous three options in any particular time frame?
Your Honor, I would say that the regulation is talking about, it's our contention, obviously, that the reg requires someone to be retirement eligible for their consideration. And I think the processes that are in place state that these things are considered by the board or the council or whoever is responsible.
Well, my question is there a time obligation on the part of the secretary? So let's assume for the moment we have a set of facts in which the individual is retirement eligible. In all respects, this Article 62 appeal is not necessary. Okay, so that's not where we are, but let's assume for purposes of my hypothetical that the individual filing an application is in fact retirement eligible, was retirement eligible at the time that they submitted the application to retire, and the only issue is their pending court-martial charges, and so there's a restriction under Table 2.2. And they need a waiver of that restriction, and the secretary is authorized to grant that waiver. You tracking with me?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. So let's assume that it's coming up there, can retire. So the secretary can say, yep, you can retire. I'm going to do it right now. Or, no, I just decided you're not going to retire. That's fine. Or, I'm going to reject it for some other reason. Could the secretary lawfully and consistent with the regulation say, I could approve this right now, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to disapprove it. I'm not going to send it back to you. I'm going to hold it. I'm going to let the trial proceed. You have permission to proceed. I'm going to let it proceed, and I'm going to wait until there's a result, and then informed by that result, I, the secretary, will decide which of the three previous options I'm going to execute.
I would assume that is within the secretary's power. I do know that, for example, if one of these is pending and a court martial has happened, the person's been convicted, a discharge, et cetera, and the decision on the retirement is still pending, that what's happened is action is held.
That's right. Yeah. Action, which is after the court martial is
over.
Right. Obviously not final action.
Right. So that would mean to me suggest that the process could continue to go on until if they were waiting for the conclusion of the court martial. And I think that's probably just frankly a result of Woods. Because in Woods they threw out the affirmed and approved conviction sentence. And if there's no further questions, I'll take up the remainder of the rebuttal.
No further questions during this part of your argument. Thank you. Appellee's counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Drew, Senior Judge Brown, and Judge Mink. May it please the Court, I'm Captain Patrick Clary. Along with Lieutenant Colonel Nicholas McHugh, we represent the appellee, Captain Harold Johnson III. This Court does not need to reach the merits of the military judge's decision because this Court lacks jurisdiction under Article 62, and there are three reasons for that conclusion. First, the underlying issue of the abatement order has become moot due to the passage of time. Second, the government's appeal was not timely under Article 62A2. And third, the abatement order did not terminate the proceedings and does not provide jurisdiction for this court under Article 62A1A. And first, to the mootness issue. According to the government's witnesses during the motions hearing, Captain Johnson's retirement package became ripe for consideration when he reached retirement eligibility at 20 years total active federal military service. That date was on 10 May 2017, so 7 days ago. So as we sit here today in this courtroom, the Secretary of the Air Force is free to take action on Captain Johnson's retirement package.
So what is your position? You heard, well, I asked a lot of questions. Let me try to narrow on one. You heard my question that I asked government counsel. What is the appellee's position as to whether there is an application that resides in an Air Force office somewhere that if the Air Force desire to do so, they could, in fact, process?
Your Honor, his retrieval package is pending. It was only submitted one time in August, the 1st of August. And it's never been withdrawn by Captain Johnson. And I think if this court finds that the application has been withdrawn, then the abatement order has become moot, and this court should dismiss the appeal, because without a pending application, there can be no disagreement among the parties. So
I think potentially there could be. The disagreement could be that the judge wants the Secretary of the Air Force to take action on a package that the government believes doesn't exist. And so we could potentially send it back, and the judge could go, I still don't have action. And the government could go, but there's nothing to act upon. And your client could go, I'm not submitting anything. I submitted it already. And so then do we just sort of wait to see how that plays out, and then take the 62 up there and go, okay, now we're confident. Now we're confident they can't come to a decision. So now we'll engage in this case. I mean, is that sort of the scenario that, or the potential scenario that that could happen as a result of us saying that we do not have jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I think the appropriate finding would be that the package is still pending, because that's how the government treated it after it was submitted on the 1st of August and was returned twice by the Special Court Martial Convening Authority.
All right, as to that point, I'm looking at the transcript, and Colonel Hugin was testifying, as he testified regarding why the, I think in this, I'm not sure if it's the first package or second package, but for purpose of the question, I don't think it's relevant. The legal advisor assigned to review the case file determined it was not right for consideration by the board, in essence, because your client was not eligible to retire at the time that he submitted the request for the waiver of the requirement or restriction. So it's unclear to me from the record that this is somehow cured just because now he could submit, maybe, which is, we can hit to that a little bit, that he might be able to resubmit now, but since he submitted it, arguably, when he was not eligible, there's no package on which they can act upon now. It isn't clear to me from the record. That's all I'm saying. And if you can point me to something that, at least like the best argument you have, based on the record, that hey, there's a package out there that the government can grab and run with whenever they want, then I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Honor, my position is that it was submitted one time in August by Captain Johnson, that it was twice returned by the Special Court Martial Competing Authority, and the government acted as if it was still pending throughout that time. So after it kind of gave up, after losing the motion for reconsideration and began processing the package, at least the government acted as if it was still pending, and the military judge certainly assumed that by issuing an abatement on the 1st of March that the package was still pending. So I don't see a point in the record where it was withdrawn affirmatively by Captain Johnson.
And it was, in fact, processed.
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
After the judge's two written rulings, the government did, in fact, process that same original package, taking it all the way up to at least outside within the reaches of the Personnel Council.
Yes, Your Honor, and the command throughout the process also assumed that it was still pending. You see a legal review from the section commander in Air Force Base Command. You see a legal review from the 14th Air Force Command, or a recommendation, rather, for secretarial action. So all the parties at play during trial, including the command, were under the assumption that the package was still pending.
So, Counsel, is it your position that this court can look at the AFI and we can make in the testimony and everything else, and we can make a determination, or that we should make a determination, as a legal question, whether there is in fact a package to be acted upon, at least to the extent that we believe that that question is necessary for us to determine whether or not we have jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I don't think that's a legal question necessarily, but more of a factual question that's apparent in the record for the reasons I just cited.
All right. So then you would. So then, since it's a fact, so your argument is, or your position, it's a factual question that we are not authorized to find facts. If that was our concern, you would suggest the remedy would be to send this back for additional fact finding as to whether there is a package currently in play that just hadn't been acted upon, but that at some point, either now or on 15 August, can be acted upon?
No, Your Honor. The facts in the record demonstrate that all parties were operating under the assumption that the package was pending. It was never withdrawn by Captain Johnson, and repeatedly throughout the hearings, they were asking for the package to be processed for secretarial action. So, and the government acted that way, Captain Johnson's trial defense acted that way, so did the judge.
And certainly you heard the argument that we just had, where the appellate government now is certainly asserting something contrary to what you're just saying. So does that sort of dovetail into, I think you had some estoppel argument, because at one point the government treated something one way, the appellate government cannot now articulate a different position? Is that how you, because I'm sure government should clarify, but everything I heard is they're not conceding what you're saying everyone is assuming is true. Right, at least at this point. They're going, there's not a package. There's nothing we can do. That's what we submitted.
Yes, Your Honor. There's no practical difference between what the Special Court Martial Convening Authority did early in the process and what the Air Force Personnel Board did at the end of February by returning it without action. It was never withdrawn by Captain Johnson. It's our position that it's still pending.
I understand your position. Thank you.
So I want to make sure that I'm clear. So your position is that there was only one package that was submitted in August of 2016.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was supplemented at some point, I think it was September.
The 20th of September, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
To make it conditional only to retire as an officer, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's your position that was legally effective and that the appellee had the authority to limit his retirement application in that way?
Right, I don't have an opinion on that particular issue, but I think for purposes of jurisdiction, what's important is that Captain Johnson has reached retirement eligibility as defined by the government's witness and their affiant.
As an enlisted member?
Yes, Your Honor.
He is not, you agree, he is not currently eligible under the statute to retire, as of today at least, as an officer?
Not until the middle of August, Your Honor. Yeah.
So if that package that the one package, if it's still in play, so to speak, your position is that's a retirement package to retire as an officer.
Your Honor, the distinction that the government's witness made during the motions hearing on the 1st of March was that there's two distinct processes here, and for purposes of jurisdiction, we'll assume that the government's interpretation is correct. But the first process is an application for the removal of a condition on one's retirement. And that goes through separate channels as different documentation. And then the next process is an actual application of retirement. So for purposes of the first process, that's where the retire level falls. It's a request to the Secretary of the Air Force to remove a condition on Captain Johnson's retirement, which is his pending court martial. So for that process, what's required, according to the government's witness and the affiant, is that he reached 20 years total active federal military service. We've reached that point as of today, as of 7 days ago, actually. So
the request to remove the restriction, you're saying, came to fruition when he reached 20 years eligible?
Yes, sir. So that's where we're at today. So it sort of begs the question of why are we here if the government can stick to its position and act on this package while maintaining his position and essentially cure the abatement order. And so at this point, the delay to the court martial isn't so much the judge's abatement order, but it's the government's appeal. But for that reason, Your Honor, I think that this issue is moot and this court lacks jurisdiction to handle it because the abatement can essentially resolve itself. There's no longer an underlying dispute that's causing a delay in the court martial. The second reason why this court doesn't have jurisdiction on Article 62 is that the appeal was not timely. And in my motion to cite supplemental authority, I offered this court the Reddinghouse case, and I think it's instructive on this issue because what happened in that case is that trial counsel had notes that were ordered to be produced to the defense counsel, and initially they complied with that order. There was some intervening litigation, and about a week later they decided that we don't want to abide by this court's order and we're going to seek an Article 62 appeal. And what this court said is that the appropriate timeline to consider is the point at which the military judge made his or her order. And just because you've changed your mind at a later date doesn't mean that you can file an Article 62 appeal because it doesn't toll for that period of time. I think that that case is instructive here because really where the government got its final order from the military judge was after it lost its motion for reconsideration. And the judge's opinion came out on 16 October. So they didn't file their notice of appeal until the very beginning of March. So we have nearly a five-month period where this issue was pending. The parties haven't changed their positions, but the government didn't seek an appeal from this court.
Wait a minute. Now, I mean, there is significant change between that time frame and March. And again, we have permission to proceed, and we have a trial judge who appeared, well, I don't say appeared, in fact, was more than willing to proceed to trial on the 30th of November. And it was but for the continuance requested at your client's behest because of a discovery issue, the case then gets continued until the end of February. And at the time that the judge was ruling in both of his written rulings, I believe there's some specific language he puts in there where he says that it could be considered possibly a continuance until the government processes it. And then there's some discussion. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't recall the exact language. But there's some clear discussion indicating that it's probably not something that could be appealed because it is in the nature of a continuance, as distinguished by what the judge says on 1 March, when he makes clear, whether we agree or disagree, that intractability has set in, and that he believes at that point, again, we're not necessarily bound by his belief, but that he believes at that point that now it is ripe for a potential appeal under Article 62. In fact, he initially says the case is dismissed and then corrects himself with the assistance of the Civilian Defense Counsel to say it's abated. So that, what the trial judge says on the 1st of March is quite different than what he had said in writing on the original ruling and the ruling in response to the request for reconsideration. So your position is, despite all of that, that the statute time, the statutory time to appeal under Article 62 started running back in August?
No, Your Honor, in October when the military judge issued his ruling on the motion for reconsideration.
And I'm sorry, that's correct. Yeah, I stand corrected, in October.
Yes, Your Honor. So the first response is that the way the military judge characterizes his own order doesn't determine, for the purposes of determining this court's jurisdiction, it's not determinative for its appealability.
But do you agree the trial continued on the 30th of November?
Yes, Your Honor, it did.
So how in the world could the abatement that the government is now appealing go back at least a month in terms of the timing when trial is proceeding? There's no reason to appeal anything. Trial is proceeding.
Because after the judge issued his ruling on the motion for reconsideration, the government acted as if it was complying with the military judge's order.
And in fact, it was complying. It processed the application, did it not?
So essentially, it cut its losses and it decided to abide by the cut.
And that's certainly well within the authority of the government. But what the government is appealing today is not the original ruling or the ruling on reconsideration, but rather the judge's ruling on the 1st of March, which was a response. The judge's ruling was a response to the returning without action from the personnel council, was it not?
Rather, it was the same position that he gave the government in the middle of October, is that the parties' positions didn't change, their legal arguments didn't change. All that changed is that the government attempted to comply with the government's order, ran into a roadblock from the personnel council.
Well, you have limited time, so I don't want to waste any more of your time on this line of argument. Why don't you move on to your next
point? Yes, Your Honor. The third reason why this court doesn't have jurisdiction under Article 62 is that the abatement order is not a termination of these proceedings. The abatement order in this case is best characterized as a continuance. The judge did not dismiss charges. He didn't prevent the court martial from happening. This court martial will happen at some point when the secretary takes action on the retirement package, and that can happen, as I said earlier, as early as today or 7 days ago.
So, but you heard the government's argument that they don't believe, based on what's in the record, that there's anything to act upon. So how is that not an intractable position? Government doesn't think they have anything to act on. Appellee thinks they do. What makes you say the trial will continue? Because at this point, what's going to change that's going to make the trial happen?
If there's no retirement pending, Your Honor, then there's no abatement. The abatement is premised on the idea that there is a pending retirement application, and the Secretary of the Air Force, at least through a delegee, is not taking action on it due to the lack of right.
Well, there may not be a basis for an abatement, a legally correct basis for abatement, but in fact, the military judge did abate, and that is the current status of the case.
Well, there wouldn't be a factual basis, Your Honor, for the abatement either. I think all the parties were assuming throughout this process that the abatement order, the retirement package was pending. And that's how the command acted, that's how the defense counsel, Captain Johnson, acted, and that's how the government acted. But it hasn't been withdrawn at any point. So this is a new argument I'm hearing from the government that there is, in fact, no pending retirement package. So if that were the case, then there would be no abatement, no factual basis for an abatement, and this appeal should be dismissed.
So if I understand you correctly, you believe it's within the authority of the Secretary of the Air Force at this moment to take the application that was filed in August and act on it by retiring your client as a staff sergeant?
At this point, Your Honor, according to the government's interpretation of the regulation, the Secretary of the Air Force would be removing a condition on Captain Johnson's ability to retire. So currently, because of his court-martial charges, according to their interpretation, he cannot retire and first has to request the removal of that condition, and that has ripened at this point. That's what a retire is. It's a request to remove a condition, so that has ripened as of 7 days ago.
Well, it's actually multiple things, and in this case, it's even more. Normally, it's a request to remove or waive a restriction, in this case, a restriction under Table 2.2, that being pending court-martial charges and trial hasn't started yet, which is a different issue. So it's a request to waive a restriction, followed by once the restriction has been removed, then grant the request to retire and, in fact, retire. That's the normal circumstance, correct?
Your Honor, I can't speak generally what the right process is, but according to Colonel Jay Ashen, her testimony, she described it as two distinct processes that have different paperwork and then flow through different offices.
That's right. But it's a request to remove a restriction followed by a request to retire.
Yes, sir.
And in fact, in this case, it's more complicated than that. Of course it is. Under the AFI, because your client is enlisted, the AFI does, there's a lot of things the AFI doesn't say, but one of the things the AFI does say is it indicates there is no legal authority under the statute to retire an officer in an enlisted rank, in an enlisted status. But they have created a process which allows them to get there in the appropriate circumstance. Those circumstances being where you have an officer who has 20 years or more of total active federal military service, but does not have 10 years or more of total active federal commission service. And the process is that the individual requests to resign, followed by a request to immediately be enlisted, followed by a third request to immediately retire in the enlisted grade. Now it appears, and certainly in the processing of this case, that it's been treated that even though the AFI talks about that as being three legally distinct steps and necessary in order to be able to retire somebody, because they talk about an officer is not eligible to retire under the statute for enlisted retirements, that you have to go through that process. And it appears that the government has sort of construed the request, hey, I want to retire and enlisted, as a request to go through all those three steps. But in our case, before those three steps can occur, you have the preliminary step that you've identified, which is the request to waive the restriction in Table 2.2, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what the retilo is. At least that's my understanding of what the retilo is. And that...
No, the retilo is all of that. It's a request to retire in lieu of court-martial. It's not a request to lift a waiver so I can consider submitting my request to retire. It's a request to retire in lieu of court-martial, is it not?
Your Honor, according to the testimony of Colonel J.H., she described the retilo as a removal of a condition or restriction on one's ability to retire.
Well, there are multiple things going on, and different offices, as you point out, have different parts of that. And there's lots of different pieces of paper, and the government basically, and I guess late October was, asserted that the original application filed in August was, quote, incomplete because it didn't include two additional attachments that are buried somewhere in that personnel document, specifically some counseling statement and then some other AF form, whatever, that had to be put in. And because it was an incomplete application at the time it was originally submitted, therefore it wasn't, quote, timely, and therefore the government could request permission to proceed. Because as you know, normally, and at least in the case of a resignation in lieu of, if a resignation in lieu of is filed within, I think it's 5 days or 5 duty days, something like that, of service of charges, then permission to proceed is generally denied. Or I'm sorry, permission to proceed is denied and the case is generally held or delayed pending application. So the government, recognizing that your client actually filed his request, whatever it was, within that 5-day window, I think it was like within 3 days, said, well, but it was an incomplete request because it didn't include these two forms. And apparently, JAJM accepted that interpretation and granted permission to proceed.
That's right. That was found in the SJA's request for permission to proceed.
Right. Exactly.
That's right.
That's the analysis they used.
That's right.
So the point being is, the one document we're looking at, or if you get, or I guess supposedly two documents, the August document and then this supplement in September, that was not the whole package. There were other things that went in there, some of them that required, like I said, this, you know, I've been counseled, a counseling statement, and then some other, you know, personal paperwork. There were various things that go in. Some of them have implications in the court-martial proceedings, the in lieu of court-martial, but there are others that are purely personnel-related. And so JAJM may or may not, it's unclear from the record, see all of that information. And so the idea that the request to waive the restriction goes out through JAJM doesn't necessarily mean that the retirement application itself would go through. I mean, it's not entirely clear.
I agree, Your Honor. I think what's important for purposes of judging this abatement order is the timeline and Captain Johnson's eligibility to retire, at least as described by both the witness and the government's affiant, that he's reached 20 years of service.
As of
10 May.
Right.
And so at this point, the government can stick to its guns. It can maintain its position regarding ripeness for that retirement package. But at least according to the information in the record, Secretary of the Air Force can take action on that package.
All right. So I understand all that. Let me take you right to the merits of the case. I understand your position is there's no jurisdiction, so we don't ever have to get there. But, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. So with regard to the merits of the case, what is your position? Reference to the AFI or statute or something else that says that your client was authorized to submit his request to waive the restriction, the Table 2.2 restriction, before he was, quote, eligible to retire. In other words, before now or before August, depending on which date you end up going with.
Your Honor, the appropriate analysis would be the analysis used by the military judge, and that there was no distinction, at least in the face of the regulation, between those who submit a removal of conditions on their ability to retire and those who are applying for a normal retirement, at least in terms of the timeline and when you're eligible to make that submission.
All right, well, let me ask you this. Do you agree, and it appears that your counterparts at the trial level do, but I want to see if you agree. You agree at the time that your client was applying for retirement in lieu of court-martial back in August of last year, that there was a restriction that was applicable to his case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was a Table 2.2 restriction, specifically that there were pending charges?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's Note 4.
Yes, Note 4 of Table 2.2. You in your pleading, you reference the following paragraph, although you don't necessarily quote from it, but you do reference the paragraph. I didn't see it referenced in the government's pleadings, and I cannot see that the judge ever quotes from it, although I do believe the trial defense counsel also references the paragraph, but again, doesn't necessarily quote the language I'm about to quote. But my question is, I'll try to give you a little bit of a moment to let the language sink in, but It appears on the face of the language that it seems to be dispositive on this ultimate issue as to why the appellee was not entitled to request a waiver of the restriction or request to retire prior to actually being eligible at the 20-year point. And this is the language. And it's paragraph 2.1.4.1. And it comes under the general heading of 2.1.4, which is entitled Active Duty Retirement Application Deadlines. And here's the language in 2.1.4.1. It's, if no restrictions apply for active duty retirements, the application may be submitted up to 12 months in advance of the desired retirement date.
Mr. Renner, I'm familiar with that paragraph.
So why did that not end the whole discussion? I mean, in the, being the discussion of whether he could apply. It seems to say, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about, well, you know, Air Force practices, you can apply to retire up to 12 months ahead of time. But it, but that language seems to clearly state that the ability to apply 12 months ahead of time only applies if there's no restriction. And in this case, and in every case in which there's a retirement in lieu of, regardless of whether the individual is eligible to retire or not, let's assume your client had 22 years time in service at the time he was applying. He was still under restriction because he was pending court-martial charges. And this would suggest that if you're pending a restriction like this one, that you cannot apply 12 months in advance, which simply means if you're eligible today, you can apply today, but you can't say, but I don't want to retire for 12 months. Or if you're not eligible today, you can't apply today and say, I want to retire in the future when I am eligible. This suggests you can only apply at the time that you're eligible to retire and not up to 12 months in advance. Does it not?
Your Honor, I agree that there are some provisions in the AFI and the PSDG that suggest the government's position is the right one. And then there are other paragraphs in the AFI and the PSDG that support the military judge's interpretation. For example, paragraph 3.2 that references table 2.1 and 2.2, and then again references the timeline for up to 1 year and no later than 120 days before the requested retirement date.
Right, so table or paragraph 3.2, which is the only one the judge talks about. He does not talk about the one I just quoted. And table 3.2, which I believe you do actually quote the language in your pleadings, says, subject to prohibitions in table 2.1 and restrictions in table 2.2, eligible active component members may apply for an active duty retirement no earlier than 1 year and no later than 120 days before the desired retirement date. So again, it says subject to those same prohibitions and restrictions. Now, you could read that possibly in a couple different ways. It's not the clearest language in the world. But when you take that, coupled with what I already read, it seems to suggest the same exact thing. If there is a restriction or a prohibition, which is table 2.1, then you can apply in advance. I mean, it seems to say the same exact thing. Now, I know the judge interpreted it differently, but he did not talk about the clearer provision of 2.1.4.1.
Your Honor, I disagree that the AFI and the PSDG are as clear as you're suggesting, and I think that position is supported by the testimony of the government's own witness, who acknowledged that this regulatory scheme is unclear, and in fact that the Air Force was taking steps to provide guidance to clarify this particular issue. So that begs the question, why would the Air Force feel the need to clarify this AFI in this particular issue if the guidance were clear and there's one single objective analysis that can be made?
But didn't that same witness and frankly every other piece of evidence in the record indicate that nevertheless the Air Force's consistent and continuous practice has been and has always been that an individual applying for a retirement in lieu of court-martial can only do so when they are eligible to retire?
Yes, Your Honor, that was their position. But I point Your Honor to the portion of Colonel J.H.'s testimony where the military judge says something, and I'm paraphrasing, but he says, I want to get this right. I don't want to provide any correct ruling. Tell me in the regulation where it makes the distinctions that you're making. And the response isn't, oh, it's this particular paragraph or this citation. It's, well, this is how the lawyers that process these applications interpret regulations. And so he isn't given any concrete regulatory citation to rely on when he's making his decision. The only guidance he gets are the affidavits that are attached to the motion for reconsideration and Colonel J.H.'s testimony. And there's a portion in the affidavit, at least from AFPC, that suggests all folks under court-martial charges, regardless of their time in service, are prohibited from submitting a retitle. And that's not the position of the Air Force.
Right, ever. Citing that Table 2.1 applies, which is a non-waivable prohibition.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we will see ultimately how we rule, but needless to say, that was not a terribly persuasive position. It certainly wasn't persuasive to the military judge, and it certainly seems to be inconsistent with everything else. That is, you can, under the right circumstances, in fact, request to retire in lieu. But as far as you know, the military judge was not pointed to paragraph 2.1.4.1, nor did the military judge quote that paragraph or otherwise apparently interpret that regulatory language in his ruling or analysis. Is that correct?
Your Honor, standing here, I don't know for sure whether that was referenced, but I can check the record and provide an official pleading.
And counsel, your point potentially cuts another way as well. The point being that you just made, as I understand it, is that the guidance is less than clear. It's potentially ambiguous. I believe the witness also said they're in the process of clarifying it so that it's easier for people, apparently they're not experts, to read this. Wouldn't that also, or shouldn't that also have caused caution for the military judge to wade into an area that is, as you describe, seems to be very kind of confusing and lots of stuff are there? I mean, does he even have the expertise to be able to do that?
That's right. I think unlike a lot of regulatory cases where we're analyzing regulations from agencies, this kind of regulation in the 36 series AFI isn't the kind of thing that requires expertise or a specialized degree. It's not a securities regulation or an EPA regulation, and that the judge, like all lawyers in the Air Force, are often asked to look at these regulations and make sense of them. And what he did was he looked at it, he applied the language of the regulation, he asked for guidance from those that process these packages. They didn't provide any concrete guidance. So what he did was he stayed faithful to the regulation and was twice acknowledged to have a reasonable interpretation by the government during the motions hearing. They twice said, Your Honor, your interpretation is reasonable. And now they're taking a contrary position on appeal.
Okay, so the situation is, and that is certainly a portion of the testimony, but I guess the other piece of it was this one judge who says this is my interpretation of this otherwise potentially ambiguous AFI. The other information that came out is that all these other attorneys that actually practice in this every day came to the opposite conclusion. So what you would advocate is because the judge is a judge, they win. In other words, we've got 40 or 50 other attorneys that do this every day and interpret this ambiguous provision. Could be interpreted, let's say, either way. And then you've got the judge that goes, but I happen to interpret it this way. All right, judge, you win. It's your courtroom. I mean, is that kind of where we are?
Well, I think the appropriate analysis is, did the judge apply the regulation in a reasonable way?
Why should we, as an appellate court, defer to the military judge's interpretation of the instruction? To the extent that the military judge could come up and say, this is what this instruction says, why is this appellate court not in the same, or maybe even potentially a better position, because we have three attorneys that can look at this AFI as opposed to this one trial judge that is out there trying to figure out what this means. Because as you pointed out, the judge is like, help me, I don't understand your argument. Please tell me why I'm wrong.
And they didn't provide any guidance.
And they did. Right. But so I guess my question is, so why should we give all this deference to the trial judge who seems to be begging someone, be it the witness in the stand or this court, to say this is how it should be interpreted? Why should we give any deference to that? I mean, just it seems odd to me that we would just go, oh, no, he said it, and he wasn't sure, but he seemed to say, unless someone could tell me different, this is what I'm going with. We shouldn't tell him different if that is what we how we interpret.
Well, in fact, he specifically said, if the appellate courts disagree, I'm sure they'll tell me, or words of that effect.
Yes, Your Honor, I've practiced with this judge before. He's very candid on the record. I think, Your Honor, that this court doesn't need to be the final arbiter of what retirements in the Air Force mean. And this court, look at the military judge's decision.
So who should? Should the trial judge in one particular case be the final arbiter, or should it be someone else?
I think the Air Force ought to follow its own regulations.
So that's interesting, because the Air Force in other regulations, personnel regulations, has established a scheme of administrative review and appeal. And this brings into mind the concept of exhaustion of administrative remedies, and that is whether or not this court or the trial court, for that matter, is authorized to even weigh into this area. When, if your client's position is, hey, the Air Force is not properly processing this personnel action, shouldn't he be required to exhaust his remedies through that same personnel system to include potentially the Discharge Review Board if it applies, but certainly the Board for Correction of Military Records or one of these other boards that are established under the same personnel council scheme that are there specifically to with expertise and experience, to look at these kinds of things? Why should we not just say, this is a really hard one, but neither the military judge nor this court is in a particularly good position to try to interpret these personnel regs. We should leave it to the personnel community and the system that the Secretary of the Air Force has established to review it in the first instance, and if there's a disagreement, to appeal it in the secondary instance.
Your Honor, I think the Air Force has established that retirements are really important, that it's a major entitlement that the government provides to those who have served for a significant period of time. And it's so important that the Air Force has decided to incorporate retirements or resignations in lieu of court-martial into court-martial procedure through 51201. So although retirements in lieu of court-martial are only referenced very quickly in a regulation, the way that they're treated, at least in this case, is that RILOs and retilos are described interchangeably. And a retilo and a RILO have the ability to stop a court martial. So we have incorporated that.
But doesn't that reference basically say, if you have one of these things, call JJM, and JJM answered the phone apparently, gave their advice, and now we're all saying, oh, but that advice was wrong. I mean, it seems like all the AFI says is defer to JJM, and the trial judge is saying, I don't think so. So how is that not contrary to what the AFI suggests?
Well, underlying that reference in 51201 is 3632.03. I mean, one can't exist without the other. So the military judge is certainly in his lane by analyzing the Air Force statement on how these procedures are supposed to apply. And, Your Honor, I don't think that he was abusing his authority as the government is claiming. Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I briefly conclude?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Your Honor.
This court does not have jurisdiction to hear this appeal under Article 62 because the appeal is not timely, the issue is moot, and the abatement did not terminate the proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Government counsel, and to be clear, you still have your full 8 minutes intact. I didn't steal from you then. I won't make any promises going forward.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your initial question about was there a resubmission, I don't know if I necessarily want to wade all the way back into this, but I will point out that Appellate Exhibit 1, which is the initial retilo application, at page 91, there's a letter in there that is asking for reconsideration and resubmission to the Special Court Martial Convening Authority when he denied it the first time. So obviously this isn't applicable. This doesn't show the facts as far as the second time around.
Did you have a page number?
Yeah, Appellate Exhibit 1 at 91.
Page 91.
And that was, so the first time it went up, the special court martial immunity authority turned it down and returned it. And then there's a letter in there from Appellee's trial defense counsel asking for reconsideration and resubmission. This obviously isn't a letter pertaining to after the military judge's ruling, but I just like to point that out.
I got it.
I'd also like to point out that as far as whether there's a package currently submitting obviously comes in play when this court's deciding whether there's jurisdiction under Article 62. But I don't think that that question, answering it one way or the other, moots the issue. Because what you have is you have a military judge abating the proceedings because it's telling the Air Force to submit the package for action up to the Secretary of the Air Force. So regardless of whether, I guess the package is still in play, if the Air Force doesn't take the action the military judge has ordered, which is to submit a retitle on behalf of Pelley, then the proceedings are abated. So I think the issue is still ripe for consideration, even under an actual standard at least. I'd also like to point out, as you noted, paragraph 2.1.41 and paragraph 3.2, it was cited, the United States cites that and analyzes it on page 20 of our brief, both of those paragraphs. You'll notice the military judge's ruling, he specifically left out the introductory language in 3.2 that says, subject to the prohibitions in 2.2 and 2.1. But I think as far as getting into the map and analyzing the regulation and parsing it out, obviously this court would do that de novo as interpreting service regulations if it doesn't apply Chevron, errors, deference. I think that even an expert here...
Let me just stop you real quick. On that point, we haven't talked about it thus far, so hopefully we won't waste too much time on it, but do you really believe that Chevron deference applies when an Air Force court, whether it's a appellate court or a trial court, is interpreting an Air Force regulation as opposed to a regulation from a different agency or even a different military service?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I think the reason is, and the decision this court can make to apply Chevron deference in this case can be very narrow. Here we have a personnel reg that's talking about a personnel process that's happening outside the court-martial. We're not asking this court to do what CAF did in Casala and defer to find criminality for a lawful order, understanding that was the FDA and it wasn't the Air Force. But I think here it's very narrow. And the principles you were talking about with my colleague as far as, the AFI deferring to JJM and why shouldn't this be with the people that do this every day? And frankly, if you've looked at the PSDG and the AFI, the 36 series, it is a specialty area. All the same principles that apply in Chevron and Hare and Hordlicky.
I think that's kind of where I'm going, though. Is it really Chevron deference, or is it simply a recognition of the expertise of people within the same agency that work in these areas day to day? But it's something short of Chevron deference, because if Chevron deference applies, it basically says, whatever they say, we have no knowledge of that. We have no expertise. And in the CAF case, they really focus on that. How does CAF know anything about FDA matters? They don't. They have no expertise in that. That's not their area of practice. But no one was suggesting that CAF didn't have any expertise in Air Force or Army or Marine regulations that deal with matters that come into a court-martial. Now, again, we're talking about a personnel matter. That is part of the issues, is where are the lanes. But I'm not so certain that true Chevron deference applies, even if something analogous to it might come into play when we're talking about personnel matters that are not military justice matters specifically.
And I didn't brief the case, but I think one of the lesser deferences is Skidmore. And I'm trying to remember which one of the cases goes into Skidmore, and I believe it may be Hordlicky. You'll see in that case they kind of work their way down through the different kind of deferences and everything else. And so a Skidmore deference, and I believe that may have been identified in one of the Canadian Marine Corps cases I cited, I apologize. But it's this recognition that there's at a minimum deference granted, not to the Chevron level at least. And I think an expert is appropriate here. I understand the level of...
So you think of what's appropriate?
If it's Article 62, if you don't have jurisdiction, the issuance of a writ of mandamus is appropriate here. And I understand the levels we're playing with here. But the reality is, the United States contends that the military judge was outside the scope of his authority, which certainly would be a usurpation of judicial authority. Second, even if the judge was in his lane, then I think the failure to grant deference is in the same vein to engage in the sort of interpretation of a reg when you have agencies that are knowledgeable and to speak to it, whether that's Chevron or Chevron Arrow, which we contend, or a lesser one like Skidmore. Even at a minimum, the legal error based on the interpretation warrants relief. You see that in Howell, for example. CAF saw fit to grant relief in that case based on the military judge's erroneous interpretation of Article 13. And I think that what we have here, the fundamental legal error and basically the practical impact of telling the Air Force how to route these things, reaching into a lane, an administrative lane, whether that should be granted outside the scope or deference, it all rises to the level necessary for an extra, even understanding that standard. You know, in Mahoney, this court, and that was the one I previously cited earlier, the military judge was, they noted there was no extra necessary in that case because the military judge was indeed authorized to rule the matter and his action was not contrary to statute, subtle decision of law, or valid regulation. I think here, all three of those things, it was outside of scope, he didn't grant the necessary deference, and then it was contrary to the regulation as it's written. Now, if there's no further questions, and actually going back around, let's talk about the practical impact of this. One of the things you had people talking about when the witnesses were the fact that when somebody's pending court-martial charges, the idea is to get them out the door as quickly as possible. Not immediately, it doesn't say that in the reg, I won't say that, but it does say as quickly as possible. What you have here is a practical impact of a military judge that basically can put this stuff on hold while someone waits to take up their retirement. In other words, they submit their request to retire. It's a year until it's resolved. I don't think that's what's envisioned. I think the practical impact here just demonstrates the fault in the military judge's decision.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. If in this case the military judge, instead of basing the abatement on his interpretation of whether the appellee was eligible to submit what he submitted, he would have instead said, retirement's a real important thing. He's almost there. I'm just going to go ahead and continue this case until 1 September. So government, regardless of whether or not you think he's eligible now, it seems like we're all in agreement, he'll be eligible by 1 September. First of all, do we have jurisdiction? I assume you would say we don't have jurisdiction under Article 62, but maybe we would have jurisdiction under extraordinary writ. Is that sort of how you would analyze that situation? We'd have to determine whether to engage on a military judge's decision to continue it for that purpose?
Definitely under an extra, sir, and I think our position, when you look at the language that's in right and true, a temporary continuance is not a basis for an Article 62. But I would say there it has the ability to affect finding the sentences because it puts them to a dead stop. A military judge's ruling on a continuance is frankly reviewed by this court regularly throughout the appellate process. Granted, it's usually a denial of an appellant's request for a continuance. And I would say that the continuance, if granted, was merely, that would be done merely under equity with no basis in the law. But obviously that's distinguishable here because the interpretation of the regulation. If there's no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Yes, please.
The military judge exceeded his authority when he abated the proceedings in this case. Regardless of whether it's under an Article 62 or extraordinary writ process, the military judge's usurpation of judicial authority necessitates reversal of his abatement ruling. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. Court is now closed.
All rise.